It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. My co-host Veronica Rickert is off today. Coming up, Native Americans have a long history with the sport of boxing here in Wisconsin. We'll learn more in today's edition of Wisconsin Life. First, we're talking about a new study in Wisconsin on prevailing wage laws. These laws set the minimum wages and benefits for workers on large public projects. A new study from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance concludes that these laws cost taxpayers more than $200 million last year. Here to talk about the study and how prevailing wage laws work is Dale Knapp. He's the research director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Dale, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Rob.
So before we get started on your study, can you explain what prevailing wage laws are and how they work here in the state?
Sure. Prevailing wage laws in Wisconsin actually go back to the 1930s, and they were put in place essentially to prevent low-wage, out-of-area contractors from coming in and undercutting local contractors for public projects. And many states have them. Some states don't. They've sort of come and gone a little bit. But ours has been around since the early 1930s. And as I mentioned, they're meant to reflect local wages so that local governments, when they do their building projects, they pay at least the wage that's sort of common in their county or their labor market.
And when do these laws kick in? Is it anything a local government does or state government, or is it only certain kinds of projects?
Well, for example, for roads and highways, it's generally all projects. We looked at the building and the building projects, the big building projects, and there's several cutoffs. So any large building project is clearly subject to the law. Generally, the cutoffs are, depending on the project, $100,000 to $234,000. So most building projects are going to come under the prevailing wage laws. Now, you know, a $50,000 roofing project might not, for example, but most, you know, the bigger projects do.
Now, I know this can get a bit complicated, but broad strokes, how yes. do they calculate this prevailing wage in an area?
Well, so in general, I mean, what they do is they survey contractors throughout the state. And what they try to do is they want to know what private contractors, on average, paid their employees, and they're looking by specific occupation for private building projects. So the survey is generally looking at private employers on private projects, and then they use that data to generate a prevailing wage that would be used for public projects. Now, what we did is we really looked at this process in some detail and found several quote-unquote flaws with how we do it. You know, one is, even though this survey, contractors are required by law to fill out and return this survey, there's no penalties for not returning it. So we only get about 10% response rate. You compare that to a similar federal survey using the same employers, they get about a 70% return. And that 10% isn't necessarily a bad thing as long as the respondents, the characteristics of the respondents reflect sort of the underlying industry. Unfortunately, about 87% of the hours reported are union hours, and we know the overall industry is about 25% union. In the building and construction, it's probably a little bit higher than that. We just don't know what that percentage is, but we know we're pretty sure it's not 87%. And then the third sort of big flaw is once they get this data, one of the ways that they calculate the prevailing wage, typically you would expect they would just take the data and average it. Well, they do. They average it, but what they do is they only average the top 51% of hours. So they sort all of the wage rates from high to low, and once the number of hours for each wage gets to 51%, they only average that top half. And that tends to skew the prevailing wages above what a traditional average would be.
We're talking to Dale Knapp with the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. His group has a new study out on the costs of the state's prevailing wage laws. Okay, we set the groundwork there. You pointed towards some ways that these wages are set too high. So how much, according to this study, is Wisconsin in effect overpaying based on this law?
Well, I don't think I would exactly frame it that way. What we said is there's another survey that's out there, this federal survey that looks at average wages by occupation. And so what we did is we looked at how the prevailing wages that are calculated by the state here differ from this federal survey. And what you find is, on average, the differential is about 45%, and it varies by occupation. So using that number and using an assumption which has been generated in the literature on this, that labor costs are between 20% and 30% of the total cost of the project, essentially you get a difference of between $200 and $300 million on total project costs in 2014 of about $1.8 billion.
And I know officially Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance is not taking this study and saying the law should change this way or that way, but is there a thought that if we just did what the federal government does or other state governments do, it could cost the state less money?
Well, that's the point of the study was really about how we calculate this and sort of the flaws, and it wasn't about whether we should or we shouldn't have it. That's a totally different debate. But you know, if we have a prevailing wage law, it makes sense to collect the data, process the data, and calculate it in a statistically sound way, and I think the federal survey tells us that if you would do that, the prevailing wages that would fall out of that would be somewhat lower than what we were seeing out of our method.
Now, some of the response to this study from contractors and others has been the net effect, if we did what you're saying, would be to pay less to some workers on public projects. And there's been an argument, A, that you get what you pay for. If we pay less, we may not get the same quality of work. And that if we're paying a little more, that's okay because we're keeping in the state on board and trained a qualified construction labor force in an industry that can fluctuate up and down otherwise. So maybe even if we are paying more, there's some benefit to this. Did you try to quantify that at all in the report?
Again, we didn't. That this was more about, you know, and unfortunately for the listeners, it gets a little bit technical. But this was mostly about methodology. You know, in the end, we wanted to take a look. You know, the group that hired us wanted us to take a look at what the overall cost to taxpayers would be. But you know, the study was really about the technical details and the methodology and what that means for prevailing wages.
Now, one lawmaker, State Representative Rob Hutton, has called for a repealing the prevailing wage laws. And I know you said the report doesn't really look at that. It's more about how it's calculated, the methodology behind it. But do you think that your report could be used by those calling for either a change in the calculation or a repeal of the prevailing wage law?
Well, you know, our research gets used for a lot of things, and my guess is yes, it will probably, you know, given his proposal, you know, it will probably be used for that. You know, I'm not sure the extent to which they'll be able to use it. For one thing, it the prevailing wage law applies to the building construction, which is one part of public construction. It also applies to roads and highways and sewers, et cetera. And we didn't look at any of these other things. So we don't, you know, this study gives no, it doesn't provide any sense of really what the overall impact would be. I think, you know, in this one area, there's an impact. You know, it doesn't provide an estimate of sort of the total impact. But, I'm guessing, sure, that the, you know, those pushing for a change to prevailing wage or elimination will probably, you know, use some of the findings.
Dale, thanks, as always, for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me.
That's Dale Knapp, Research Director for the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, talking about their new study on prevailing wage laws in Wisconsin. American Indians have a long history of boxing here in Wisconsin, particularly at the amateur level. Mark Antonio Daniels Jr. trains with the Forest County Potawatomi Boxing Club, and he dreams of becoming a professional boxer.
Boxing, that's been a tradition. It's been around for a really long time, and a lot of natives, we've always been in it. It's just what we are known for is we're fighters, we're warriors, we're not quitters. We've been in this since we were kids, so we are a family here. The one thing that my dad tries to establish is that when you come here, you don't have to be scared, you don't have to be nervous. He wants everybody to see their potential and to be well-minded and good-spirited. We don't take anything away from anybody. Everybody has their own style. We're all made differently. I like to be quick, nimble, and elusive, whereas our heavyweight, William Ollie, he has a lot of speed for a big dude, and he's very good at blocking. My brother Marcus, he's come a very long way. He stayed in it. You know, he's had every opportunity to, you know, take a break or go do what he wants to do, but he wants to come back here. I think he's got something to prove. But we try to be there to help each other, push each other. You know, if somebody's struggling, we'll come back and help them. When it starts, it's like, okay, here we go. This is what I've been training for. It's time to put everything into use. Go in there, feel him out, see what he's gonna do. It's always about survival. It's about being disciplined. Then you have to take those ways and bring them into your lifestyle too. So when you become a smarter fighter, you start thinking about life, and it makes you more disciplined, more relaxed. I can usually just brush things off. Or if a guy, you know, he gets in my face or something, it's easy for me to just walk away and say, hey, that's not worth it. You know, you lose your temper, you lose. My goal is to show all of my people what we're capable of. We may not be the warriors that were back then, but we're still warriors in our own way. We're still fighters. I box for my people, not only Potawatomis, all natives. I fight for them, I fight for my kids, I fight for my dream, I fight for a reason to get up every day.
This story was produced by Finn Ryan for The Ways. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more info, visit wisconsinlife.org. Alan Caldwell joins us now for more on this unique history. He's a former boxer, boxing promoter, coach, and state boxing inspector. Alan, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So, Alan, what got you involved in boxing from the beginning?
Well, I grew up in a community where that was the only sport we had outside of some of the high school athletics. And I had several nephews and high school classmates that were boxers, and so I decided to become part of the program.
And you've pointed toward the 1960s and 70s as a heyday for amateur boxing in Wisconsin. How big a part did the state's tribal members play in that 60s and 70s scene?
At Menominee, we played a big part of it, because I remember in those days we would go to Fond du Lac for the Golden Gloves tournament, and they would have, 120, 150, 160 boxers entered in their tournament. Half of them came from the Menominee Indian Reservation.
What is it about boxing that appealed to you and other members of tribal groups here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it was the competition. Some of it had to do with situations in our home communities, where at the high schools that we attended, school sports where participation was limited by team numbers to Native athletes participating. And in some places, it was the racism that in those school systems that excluded them. So boxing became one of the ways in which we could compete as individuals, as a team, and compete for the recognition for our communities.
Now, we just heard from Mark in that piece with the Potawatomi Boxing Club, and he pointed to a warrior tradition, a warrior culture, and this being a way to honor that tradition. Was that important for you and other people you've worked with?
Oh, yes, that was very much so. In days gone by in our Native communities, we had our warrior societies, and they were the protectors. They were the ones that faced the enemy. And so over time, through our culture, we've transformed that in some of the things like the sport, such as boxing.
We're talking about boxing in Wisconsin's Native American communities with Alan Caldwell, a former boxer and coach himself. And Alan, as a coach, you've helped start boxing clubs in a couple of tribal communities. What was the response when you opened the door there from youth in those communities?
Well, I started it. I'm a high school teacher, and I was working up in La Couturier and over at the Stockbridge-Muncie communities, and in those communities with the Native students that were going to school there, I inquired about their interest in becoming involved in that. They showed an interest, so I got the equipment together and was able to start those clubs and give those youth an opportunity to compete in a sport that maybe they weren't fully aware of, but as they got more familiar with it and things, they brought other members of the community into the programs, and we were able to achieve some success.
Now, you've been participating and observing the sport for a long time. Who are some of the big names among Native Americans in Wisconsin in the boxing world?
Oh, there are a number of them. I have a nephew by the name of James Jimso Caldwell, who is still fairly well known, though he retired 35 years ago. He was a 8-time state champion. He was a national AAU champion and toured with the United States. There's J.J. Korn from Menominee, who just recently retired from his professional career, but he was a member of the all-military and the U.S. Army boxing teams when he was serving in the Army back in the 90s. Lou Boyd from Menominee. There were the Danforth brothers from Oneida, Eddie Conger from La Couturier, amongst others who achieved success in their careers as amateur boxers.
Are there efforts to bring this back, to bring boxing back these days?
Yes, there is. A couple years ago, we had the Indian Summerfest that's held in Milwaukee on the Summerfest grounds the weekend after Labor Day. And they started a revival of that. They started an invitational boxing tournament. And this past September when they held it, they had boxers from all over the state of Wisconsin. They came from Michigan and Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, and a few other places that came in and competed in the tournament.
Alan, before we let you go, for people who aren't fans of the sport of boxing, what would you say to get them to maybe appreciate it a little more?
Well, I think it goes back to what kind of my coaching philosophy was, that boxing teaches the boxers respect, it teaches them self-discipline, patience, sportsmanship, physical and mental conditioning, you know, their listening skills, their interpersonal relations, and other personal values that I think are important to us as individuals and as human beings. And I think many of the coaches and trainers who coach these boxers teach these as part of their program.
Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem.
That was Alan Caldwell, former boxer, promoter, coach, and state boxing inspector. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is off this week. Coming up, we'll hear your thoughts on the new Indiana religious freedom law that's been the subject of intense backlash from around the country. First, a look at a really difficult thing that everyone has to go through, being 12 years old. WNYC in New York City launched a series earlier this month called Being 12, The Year Everything Changes, in which they talk to kids about what it's like to be 12. Here's a clip from Elsie Marquez, a seventh grader from Queens.
Now it's like new friends, new attitude, new you. And it's just like where it starts all the drama, who's like your best friend, who's not. And also it's like, oh, who likes who, you have a crush on who, you're dating who.
Our next guest, Abigail Baird, says being 12 is kind of like a second toddlerhood. She calls it the terrible 12s, and she's with us to talk about why being 12 is so difficult and what you can do to help support the 12-year-olds in your life. And we're taking your calls, too. Did you find 12 to be a tough age for you or your kids? What is it about this time span that's such a big transition point? What was your life like at 12? Are you the parent or grandparent of a 12-year-old? How do you handle conflict with them? And are you 12 right now? What's it like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page. Abigail Baird is an associate professor of psychology at Vassar College. Abby, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So why do you think this early adolescence, 12 plus or minus a little, is like a second toddlerhood?
Well, I think that the easiest way to think about it is in terms of the amount of change that's happening. In toddlerhood, when our little guys begin to speak and start to say no and have their own opinions about things, they're growing and changing so much so fast, and it's so exciting to us, and it's new and wonderful. And then there actually is the only other time in our whole life that we will grow and change that much that quickly is the beginning of adolescence. And there are a lot of people who think it's not quite as cute and doesn't smell quite as good, but I happen to be a big fan. I think it's a critically important and functional period of time that gets you ready to be an adult.
Well, and I think for a lot of parents, maybe I'll speak for myself a little here. I've got a pair of 12-year-olds at home. This is a time of fear. Should it be?
No. It understandably is a time of fear. I think mostly because, I don't want to badmouth my own people, but science hasn't done us a lot of favors in this department, and I think the media has kind of perpetuated a lot of myths about adolescence being this, awful time of absolute stress and difficulty. And I think difficult is probably true, but difficult doesn't mean wrong or pathological. I think it's different. I think a lot is changing. And I think a lot of parents, their immediate response is, okay, my child is changing so much, I better change too. And actually, you really don't have to change all that much. And in fact, your teen would probably prefer that you don't. In the same way that a toddler is testing you, a lot of adolescents, when they're first starting adolescence, are a little nervous about everything and are checking to make sure that the boundaries are still the boundaries.
So the right reaction isn't, okay, this kid is different now, my parenting has to be different, I'm their peer in some ways now. It's, I need to provide a stable foundation as they're going through this tough transition.
Precisely. Precisely. And I think it's so tempting to want to, you know, be that best friend and confidant. And that actually, as appealing as it might seem, isn't healthy for them and is not going to help them. That's actually why teens need their peers so much, because, you know, their 12-year-old friends will tell them about 7th grade. You don't need to tell them about 7th grade. You need to tell them about what's okay or not okay in the adult world. And they're probably the exact same lessons that you were insistent on when they were 2. They're just in a slightly different package now.
So from the science and I guess from our culture, what's the deal with 12-ish? Why is this such a big time of change?
Well, I mean, I'm a brain nerd. I'll just put that out there. So neurologically, it's really fascinating. Some of the same systems that kind of explode with growth around the 2 and 3 time, the systems that support abstract thinking and reasoning, language, and sort of independent behavior all undergo really rapid growth. And we see the same kind of growth in the adolescent years. Now, they're not learning to speak a new language, but they are learning to communicate in new ways. They're learning a whole new social language because they're going through puberty. They're becoming, I know that this is probably the most terrifying sentence to parents, but they're becoming reproductively viable. So they need to learn a whole bunch of new behaviors. And, you know, I mean, you don't need a neuroscientist to tell you this. Just think about adolescent slang. You know, we can't learn the current slang, and we shouldn't be using the current slang. But teenagers can pick that up really, really quickly, and they can pick it up quickly because of the way their brain is growing.
We're talking to psychologist Abigail Baird about the difficulties and excitement of being 12, those are early adolescent years, why it can be such a big change, in effect, maybe a second toddlerhood. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your memories, your current experiences as a parent, and what you think is important about these milestone years of 12, plus or minus. Let's go right to a caller. We've got Megan with us in Mesa Mani. Megan, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
I couldn't agree with your guest more, and I just remember teaching 7th grade. I'm an English certified English teacher, and I noticed that my teaching management, my classroom management style, changed a lot in 7th grade from telling the kids, that's so naughty or you're being so rude, to being like, why are you making that choice? What is going on in your mind that would make you think that that's okay to do? And also, I noticed a lot of more openness with 12-year-olds. Like when I was having a bad mood or not on top of my teaching game, if I shared with them what was going on, they were more, they had more empathy and showed more empathy toward me as a person and as a teacher. And we could actually get more things done and discovered in the classroom.
Megan, before
that's all I wanted to say.
Megan, before I let you go, though, another part in the series, this WNYC series that prompted this conversation is who's crazy enough to teach 7th grade?
Yeah,
well,
you
see it as exciting,
crazy.
Right?
No.
It's
very crazy, but very exciting. Every day was something new, let me tell you.
All right.
I think I'm the daughter of a middle school teacher. And I think, Megan, you're one of the people. My mom said there are two types of people that teach middle school, people who love middle school kids and people who hate middle school kids. And you clearly are one of the ones who loves them like I do. So thank you for doing the job you do.
And Abby, teaching styles. She's saying it's different teaching a 12-year-old than a younger kid. Do you think there's something to what she was saying there?
Oh, 100%. And I think she said something really important that we didn't mention before, which is that part of the brain growth that happens around 12, this ability to abstract, to think about things that are not their own experience, you do start to see more empathy, more understanding of others' points of view because they're maturing. And that's part of the excitement. She's absolutely right that a lot of 12-year-olds, if you tell them what's on your mind, they will consider it. I mean, try telling a 5-year-old that you're having a hard day. They, you know, they'll just walk right over you.
Megan, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We'll go now to Reese in Wales. Reese, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. What do you think?
Well, I definitely agree with you. I have an older brother. He's 13. He's in here with the car with me. And it's definitely a big change in life because he gets to do more things because he's older. So I definitely think it's really different being 12.
Okay. And
you're not in the teens yet. Yeah.
Reese, can I ask, how old are you?
12.
12. Oh, you are 12 yourself. So are you starting to get more freedoms now? Are you able to, are your boundaries expanding a little bit at 12, or is that still a year off for you?
Yeah, definitely, because my birthday is in December, so I'm not yet in seventh grade, but it's coming little by little. I'm almost 13, so I'm almost in the teens, which will be exciting.
Reese, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story and your older sibling's story. So, Abby, that's a question, a big time of change here. How much independence do we need to give kids in this 12 to 13 range? How do you gradually widen those boundaries?
Well, actually, honestly, I think you just said it. You gradually widen those boundaries. One of my favorite things to say is parents who know their children know best. And I think, you know, as much as it's flattering for some people to say, oh, you're an expert at adolescence, I might study adolescence a lot, but I certainly am not an expert in your children. You know your children. And so I think one of the things we've been doing in recent decades is listening to experts a little too much instead of listening to our gut as parents. And, you know, if you have a 12-year-old that's very responsible, you can give them more responsibility. If you have a 12-year-old who's very young and needs more structure, then they need more structure.
We're talking to psychologist Abigail Baird about the difficulties of being 12, why she says this stage of development is like, in some ways, a second toddlerhood. We're taking your calls, too. Why do you think 12 is such a big year, or was it a big deal for you or your kid, or to just go on by smooth as silk? What were you like at age 12? What is your kid like at age 12, plus or minus a little? How do you handle the changes? How do you handle growing responsibilities and growing liberties, for that matter? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion with psychologist Abigail Baird about why she says being 12 is in some ways a second toddlerhood. We're prompted in part by a WNYC series on being 12. We've got a link to some of their information on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking your calls now. Why do you think 12 can be such a difficult age, such an exciting age? What was 12 like for you? And if you have a 12-year-old in your life, how do you handle that relationship? Call with your call with your experiences, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. We've got Melissa on the line in Madison. Melissa, hi.
Hi. I just was going to say that for me, it was a time that, because of those changes in social communication, that for someone that maybe had a hard time with it, not now, but at the time, it was definitely difficult from a psychological standpoint. For me, it was a little bit of a gateway to some mild depression, not feeling like I fit in or knew how to communicate in those new social norms.
Interesting point, Melissa. Thank you so much for sharing that. Abby, depression and other similar problems among people in this early adolescence stage.
Absolutely, especially among girls. I'm really glad that Melissa brought that up, because it is an important point to make. We know from a lot of work now that symptoms of depression pretty much double for girls when they enter puberty around 12 and 13, and there are any number of causes for this, and certainly the onset of this very complex social world and your body changing and people treating you differently. There's a lot going on, which is why I think both adolescents and parents do need lots of support. And again, you know, in the same way that we try to take care of our toddlers without overprotecting them, we do need to take care of our adolescents. As Melissa said, her social world was stressful. We can't socialize for them, but we can remind them that they have a safe home base and that we believe in them and that, you know, that it will be okay. And obviously, if things get too dark, you know, parents should never hesitate to reach out for help.
Melissa, thanks a lot for sharing that. We'll go now to Joyon in Milwaukee. Joyon, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to real quick kind of relay a story. When I was turning 12 and 13, my family moved from one state to another, and it was very difficult because I was going into like a middle school sort of transition. From there, a year later, I was going into a high school. So I was making all sorts of new friends when I first moved into middle school, and a year later, I had to start all over again because many other kids were in the same situation going into a new school. So it was working from one group I didn't know into another group I didn't know, and it really, really was very stressful.
Joyanne, thanks for sharing that. So that's you're already going through a major life transition, and now another one with a move on top of that, Abby.
Yeah, that would be pretty much a bad mix. That's a clinical term, bad mix. honestly, you know, I think it's very difficult to say parents should do this or parents should do that. But, you know, if you know that your 12-year-old is going to be moving in any, you know, having lots and lots of new social groups exposed, if it's at all possible, it's not a bad idea to try to find a social group that doesn't change, you know, maybe a sports team or a club or a summer activity or something that gives them a steady group of friends. Because having other 12-year-olds to relate to is really important. And being lonely in those early teen years is a very detrimental thing to have to go through.
Talking to psychology professor Abigail Baird about 12-year-olds, the trauma of being 12, the excitement, the opportunity of being 12 years old. Still time for your calls with your memories of 12, maybe your current existence as a 12-year-old or parent thereof. You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Mike on the line with us now in La Crosse. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share, I just retired as a French teacher. I taught for 46 years. But 20 years ago, I taught high school. 20 years ago, they started a program in the middle school. And one of my colleagues said, well, you can't teach middle school. And you don't tell someone that taught for 25 years and won awards that they can't teach. But the guy was right. It was a disaster. You have to retool. It's a totally different world. You know, they're as far as what you have to do to maintain their attention spans, which are very limited. But I found out I wasn't too old to relearn things, but you have to repackage it in a different way. It worked. But I had to relearn how to teach.
Mike, thanks a lot. I'm glad you made it through that that transition in your career. That's amazing. So again, I don't know, Abby, we don't want to talk about 12-year-olds and young adolescents as a different species, but it sounds like there's some different kinds of communication tactics needed here.
Oh, there absolutely is. And my website's called The Teen Species because I do think it's such a unique time in development that it deserves its own classification. That doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it's different. And I applaud Mike for making that transition. A policymaker in Washington once asked me what my recommendations for improving seventh grade would be. And I said, cancel it. Don't do it. Just give them a year off.
Wow.
Which was, I was only half kidding. I think that so much of middle school is about showing up, shoring up those relationships, learning how to behave, learning how to learn, you know, at school while undergoing a lot of social change and emotional change. It's rough stuff, but it's hard work that's worth it at the end of the day.
We heard from Mindy on Facebook. She writes, I went through the terrible 12s. There was much door slamming and tears. But after that year, I was a lot more pleasant. So does it really get fixed, get all better that quickly after 12 or 13 or whenever this happens? Abby? Looks like we lost Abby Baird. While we get her back on the line, remind you that we're talking about the 12-year-old year, prompted by a WNYC series on being 12. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page where you'll find out more on the topic. We have Abby back with us. So I was saying, Abby, do we recover that quickly usually from the rough spots at 12 or 13?
I think we do. I think it's important to know that people vary. You know, individuals, some individuals, it takes them a few years. Some individuals, you know, I think there are also people who, parents and adults who, you know, are totally freaking out waiting for the terrible 12s to come. And for some kids, they don't come. I think it's just important to understand that having a rough time at 12 or 13 doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you. It means that everything is right with you. So I think it's not unusual to, and you know, there are some kids who can assert their independence without slamming doors. Some kids need to slam a couple doors to assert their independence. And if that's okay within your household, then, you know, I'd say let them do it. And, you know, understand that there may be other limits as a parent you want to set that they still need to follow, but that, you know, maybe letting them have a little bit of room to express themselves in a respectful way can be healthy for them.
Get back to our callers now. We've got Kim on the line and Nina. Kim, hi.
Hi, it's Kim. I'm a father of a soon-to-be 12-year-old. And one important thing, I'm very lucky. I have a very intelligent 12-year-old, arts and active. But I've always found that I say you're a very smart person. You may do something that's dumb or stupid, but you're not a stupid person. You're a very smart person. And I always say person, not kid, because they are people. And you treat them like that. Mm-hmm. And it seems to enhance the communication that you have with them. They're still going to be kids, but they are people. And I think by doing that, you keep a line of communication open and let them know they can always come to you.
Kim, thanks a lot for that call. Abby, I heard you nodding along there.
Absolutely. 100, I couldn't agree more. What a great dad. It is so important. It's funny because we really actively think when we have toddlers about taking them seriously. And it's part of how we encourage them to behave. You know, you say, oh, you're a big boy now. You've got to, you know, do this or that. And we set an expectation of their maturity by treating them as if they're, you know, a little bit older and showing them that we respect where they're at. And that's different from saying you are an adult. But when you're taking your teen seriously and respecting their point of view while maintaining the fact that you're the parent and they're the child, I think that's a real recipe for success.
You know, with toddlers, parents go together, meet each other in the park with their kids. Everybody knows about the terrible twos. They can commiserate. Are things more isolated for parents of 12-year-olds and the 12-year-olds themselves when it comes to those shared issues?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the things that, you know, if I were queen for a day and could magically, you know, create a program, that might be, it would be close to the top of the list to have those coffee clutches and you know, secret meetings. I have a pair of 6-year-olds, and I remember when they were toddlers, everybody wanted to hear my war stories and give me advice and, you know, oh, I survived it, you'll survive it. But it's interesting when we start having questions about our teens, a lot of people back up and say, like, oh, well, they're almost adults, so, you know, you should really know what to do. They should be on their own. And we pathologize things in teenagers that are really part of the normal developmental process. That we, you know, if a toddler threw a truck across the room, you wouldn't, you know, fear of telling your neighbors because your neighbors would think your toddler's violent. They would think your toddler's a toddler. And I'm not saying throwing things is okay for adolescents, but there are some behaviors that if we were just a little more understanding about how much they're dealing with and we're open with each other, we could actually support other parents. I would love to hear from parents who are more experienced than I am, like, oh, yeah, that happened to me. Don't worry, it'll be okay. Or this, we tried this and this really worked, or this didn't work. We could do a lot better in that department.
We'll leave this with a comment from Tiffany on Facebook who writes, well, I feel better now. This explains a lot. Abby, thank you so much. You put Tiffany at ease.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Abigail Baird. She's associate professor of psychology at Vassar College. She was with us to talk about why she says being 12 is in some ways a second toddlerhood.